I got a couple of fellas from the Pima County Tax Collection Office to put up the gallows on the village square. Collecting taxes was about the same as hanging people, so I figured they knew what they were up to. And they did. They got the frame in place with the trap doors on it, and the little stairway up there, and then the uprights, and the beam. And I had Rusty build 6 nooses and let them hang there in the August breezes. They made a nice addition to the town's sights, and lots of visitors off the ranches paused to admire it. The tax boys did a good job of it, getting the upright post going straight up and bolting down the crossbeam, which I had used a few times before this. I ran a few test runs using sandbags, and the whole deal worked handsomely. When I pulled the lever, the hinged trap dropped, and the sandbags plunged downward and then dangled in the wind. I thought that maybe Spittin' Sam and Big Nose George would die with a smile, but some of those other dudes would whine and struggle. But you never knew what a man was made of until he was about to croak. Rusty was feeling mighty fine, full of joy. He had 2 wives and a boy, and how could you beat that? The Siamese twins had settled down and were no longer trying to throttle each other, so there was peace at last in Doubtful. Rusty and his family would sometimes parade up and down Wyoming Street just to show off a little. The town ladies quit gossiping and greeted the twins like long-lost sisters. Everyone in Doubtful admired Hanging Judge Earwig's fine solution to an impossible dilemma. I thought summer was about over and life would be peaceful again, except for hanging 21 cowboys. But then a slicker rode in with some fancy horses and challenged everyone to a match race with a few side bets for spice. His name was Algernon Limp, but I think he invented it to give him some advantage. Anyone in Wyoming knows that Algernon is a sissy name, and Limp is worse. It's as if his horses limped, and that was what he was trying to convey with a name like that. I studied him some and went back to my office to paw through the wanted dodgers and posters, but I didn't find anyone matching Algernon Limp's description. Actually, he was a pint-sized dandy with pinstripe black suit, a red paisley vest, and bowler hat and waxed mustachios and patent leather shoes so shiny that they pretty near reflected starlight. But Limp was more than a dandy dresser. He brought with him 3 of the finest horses I'd ever seen, full of thoroughbred blood, I thought, almost dainty in their stepping. There was a black, a bay with white stockings, and a palomino. He began by parking them at the hitch rails of the saloon, and it was plain he was letting people take a gander at him. A few cowboys had filtered back in, but the hanging was still a couple of days away, so Limp didn't have the usual bunch of drovers around to talk to. He eyed the gallows, inquired when the big day would be, and offered to run races to celebrate the event. But mostly he was waiting for the hangings to go away so he could get down to the business of staging match races between his steeds and any local talents the cowboys came up with. He stopped by the sheriff's office to inquire about a good place to run the match races he had in mind.
I have here some of the finest horse flesh not only in the territory, but in all of the United States and all of the world. Have with me a trainer, jockey, and an odds maker, Boston Bill, who will take wages laid on one nag or the other and fleece the cowboys out of their hard-earned monthly salaries.
I imagine your ponies lose a few.
I like to give that impression. In fact, I always understate the virtues of my running horses so that people are willing to test their own nags against mine. That's how I make a dandy living, and I expect to retire soon because I have husbanded my winnings and built them up.
How do you do it?
I have a quarter miler, a half miler, and a miler, all southern bred. And Egbert Angstrom, the demon Swede jockey who squeezes juice out of my turnips. I lay out the game to the local talent, and they can decide whether or not to run a match race with my plugs. If there are no takers, I move on to the next town and see who'll swallow the bait.
What if you lose?
Oh, I pay my stakes cheerfully, and my bookie coughs up, and we accept our licking. I have excellent credit with the greengrocers and Bail Bond Stock Bank of Manhattan, and I draw a certified check and head for the next burg.
You have stakes?
Of course. We each put up a stake and the winner walks away with it.
What if there's a false start?
We always have independent judges drawn from the community, one at the starting line and one at the finish.
He sure seemed to have all the answers, and he may have run a square game, but I'd reserve judgment on that. There had been so many road shows coming through Doubtful that I figured there weren't 2 nickels left to rub together. But horse racers are a different breed, and half of them are mad, and they can get all heated up faster than a virgin in a cat house.
Well, the best day for a match race would be the day of the hangings. We got 21 cowboys lined up, and we'll hang them in shifts, and maybe you could run a match race between each shift.
Oh boy, doubtful we'll have a glorious day.
How do you promote the event? The hanging's only 2 days away.
The saloons, my friend. They are regular gossip machines. Put out the word, and next thing, there's a dozen calculating strangers eyeing my livestock.
Do you exercise them so folks can watch?
Absolutely. We train first thing every morning. As soon as we measure up the track, we'll do light runs for the edification of the locals. We've got the finest horse flesh west of Kalamazoo, and we'll put it all on display.
We got some fine horse flesh around here. Over at the Admiral Ranch, Smiley Thistlewaite's been working some quarter milers that can't be beat, at least locally. Trouble is, he's scheduled to be hanged. You might want to get him to race his tomorrow before he expires.
Well, that's a thought. But ideally, he should match my nag on the day of the hanging, so if he wins, he can go to the noose happily, and the crowd can cheer him.
Well, we can schedule a little time between each shift. My deputy's got to cut down the bodies anyway and build fresh nooses. I imagine a good match race would occupy people until we're ready to hang the next lot.
Capital. Just capital. Well, I'm off to the saloons to troll a little. Wish me happy days.
After that, things sort of picked up steam on their own. Maxwell, the funeral parlor man, ordered in some ice so he could keep all them corpses cold and run the funerals by rotation with the criminals well-preserved and looking prime. The women of the Methodist persuasion planned to sell fried chicken and potato salad box lunches to the crowd. But the Episcopalians, not to be outdone, offered to set up a whole lunch counter. Hams, steaks, green snapper beans, strawberry tarts, and frosty fizzies. All donations going to the widows, if any. Cowboys were not known for getting into holy wedlock uninspired by a shotgun. And the Lutherans decided to hold a Sons of Norway lutefisk supper following the hangings, right next to Maxwell's funeral parlor, so folks could eat and view the stiffs in one tour. I toured Saloon Row that eve. It sure was entertaining. Sammy had got his saloon back in business. He bought booze from the Lizard Lounge and Mrs. Gladstone's sampling room, so he didn't have to wait for a shipment from Denver. He didn't have much variety, but that didn't matter. Who cares about taste? There were cowboys in town from all the ranches, but none of the condemned. They were smart enough to steer clear until the last. And sure enough, there was Algernon Limp, the center of attention, boasting up his nags. He chose Mrs. Gladstone's sampling room, mostly because Kronk ran a faro game there, and betting was what the place was all about.
Now, friend, my quarter miler is unbeatable. His name is Booth, after John Wilkes Booth, and he is the terror of the West. He was born and bred in the South. If you'll put up $100 as a stake, win a take all, I will match you, and we will race tomorrow.
$100? Where am I gonna get $100?
You form a pool with your pals from the ranch.
Well, I got a quarter stallion, and it can't be beat. And it's mean enough to take a piece of hide off of yours. Ain't that the truth?
Well, then you've got an easy 100. You got 10 friends? Have them put in 10 and win 10. Or they can make side bets, too, with my bookie. He'll post the odds, and you can bet or not as you choose. You want to lay $2 on my nag or his nag? See the bookie.
We'll match you and race tomorrow.
And Algernon Limp was smiling like he owned Doubtful. Hanging day would be hot and sunny, I thought, eyeing the cloudless sky. That's fine. Better to hang 21 in sunshine rather than rain or overcast. Everybody would see well if there was plenty of sun. The first hanging was scheduled for 10 in the morning. After lunch and the first match race, the second hanging would be held at 2, followed by another match race, and the third hanging would be at 4, and any leftovers would be hanged at 6. There wasn't much shade at the gallows, but some nice cottonwoods lined the square, and people could collect there in good shade for the big events. Rusty and I were all set. I'd tie the wrist to the hangee, put a noose over his head, and pull the lever whenever we got one bunch ready. Rusty, he would cut the noose free and cart the corpse to Maxwell's wagon. Then Rusty would build another noose and we'd dangle it from the crossbar. We didn't know how many would show up for their croaking, but we'd be prepared. I'd gotten plenty of rope from the mercantile and some thong to tie up wrists. Enough to hang all 21 if need be. There were a couple of preachers around, just in case the condemned wanted the last rite, and these fellas lounged in canvas chairs, waiting to be called upon. By the time I got to the town square, crowds were already collecting. Many brought blankets to sit on, and wicker baskets filled with chilled sandwiches and iced tea. The ladies were all in summery white gauze, and their daughters wore white pinafores or cream-colored little dresses. The town's gents tended to stand and wait solemnly for the day's events to roll. It was a noisy crowd, with little boys and dogs circling in packs through the mob and a few horses shying from all the ruckus. But finally, 10 o'clock did roll around, chimed by the courthouse clock, and Judge Earwig, wearing his judicial robes and a silk stovepipe hat, promptly emerged from his chambers, stepped up on the gallows with a borrowed megaphone, and began the show.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we will now hang the malefactors who trashed Sammy Upward's Last Chance Saloon a few days ago, a crime unspeakable and unequaled in the history of Wyoming. Will the following criminals please step forward to meet your moment of destiny with the news?
Sylvan Boot, Max Dell, Carson McCullough, Wagner Wick, Delbert Battles, and Jocko Mortensen."
I waited for the culprits, but no one emerged from the crowd.
"Step forward and take your medicine."
But blamed if anyone stepped up. Earwig pulled his giant timepiece from somewhere in the interior of his cloth tent, eyed the hands, and stuffed it under his robes again.
"All right. Since no one among them is man enough to take his medicine, I will require that they be hanged in absentia. The sheriff will drop the trap, in token of which the criminals will be dispatched in absentia, and the first lot of criminals will be carted off to the undertaker in absentia."
It sure was entertaining. I had the attention of the mob, all right. I climbed the little wooden stair, stood at the lever until Earwig dropped his arm, and I pulled the lever. The floor underneath the row of nooses suddenly swung down, and the crowd stared, and then cheered. Maxwell drove the bodies, removed in absentia, to the funeral parlor, where they would be on display in absentia.
"All right, you may eat your lunches. The next recreation is at 2. Oh, and there's a match race scheduled at 1.
The charity jar rested prominently on the gallows, and pretty soon I saw some of those miscreants slide up and drop some greenery into it. They were all ruined men, marked forever by their cowardice. They sure were smiling a lot. Max Dell, he had pulled a cheroot and was firing up. Lots of fellas were patting his back. A few wandered off to the funeral parlor, where Maxwell had arranged for the absentees to lie in state, a block printed name at the head of each bier. A few folks studied the list of the shamed, and a few tossed pennies onto the bier, which Maxwell snapped up as his rightful fee.
"Hey, Sheriff, it sure is fine."
"Hey, maybe I should hang you, Reggie. You want to volunteer? Confess to countless crimes in office first?"
"I'll see you fired one of these days."
It sure was a fine August day, even if hot. A mess of people were digging into their box lunches. Children were playing hangman on the gallows, and I had to chase off a little squirt who got his neck into a noose. A little after noon, the crowd drifted along Wyoming Street to the improvised race course that Limpet set up there. The horsemen in town had all drifted that way earlier and were standing around gauging the nags, making sage comments about how one or another was built for racing and muscled up in the chest and flanks and had a wild look in the eye and all that. There were a mess of them who thought that Limp's quarter gelding, Booth, would triumph. But there were plenty of others who'd gathered around Bark's ranch horse, named Sherman, and eyeing his hooves and flanks and the look in his eye. Limp knew what he was doing, naming his nag after Lincoln's assassin, just to stir up some passions and some heavy bet. Wyoming was northern turf, even if most of those cowboys on the ranches had drifted up from the old Confederacy. Limp, he just stood quietly, letting nature take its course. But his bookmaker had a little blackboard and chalk that he was using to take bets. Every time he made a bet, he put the bills in a little black bag that he tucked into his pocket. He wasn't bleating either. Limp's outfit was simply standing around, taking money from bettors, while shrewd observers studied the two nags. Limp's other horses were on display, but in rope corrals a bit away. There was his bay half-miler, Robert E. Lee, and his black one-mile thoroughbred, Jefferson Davis. Both of them prime horseflesh, lean, nervous, wild of eye, and restless. There were plenty of cowboys studying those two, professing to know their bloodlines, plumbing their ancestry, citing hoary records and victories to make their case. Limp had run a chalk starting line along the path, and a quarter mile down, a chalk finish line. The match race would begin when the starter fired a shot. If either horse broke early, the judge would blow a whistle, and the horses would return to start once again. Bark had got a crazy ranch kid to jockey for him, but Limp had put his mad Swede in purple silks so that the limp horse looked like a serious racer, and the ranch horse, Sherman, and his jean-clad rider looked like something cobbled up locally. I watched the good citizens of Doubtful lay bets with the bookie. I watched Mayor Waller squander $3 on Bark's horse, Sherman. But then I watched Turk, the liveryman, who knew a thing or two about nags, push a 10 spot to Boston Bill that bought him an additional 11 if Booth won.
You like the looks of that Palomino, do you?
It's no contest. That quarter gelding's got heat in him.
You're the man who should know. For once, he didn't take it as an insult. I sure as the dickens didn't know which nag would win, so I focused on keeping the peace. I hoped Rusty was keeping an eye on the nooses back on the square so a bunch of bratty boys wouldn't hang a dog or something like that. Denver Sally, my favorite madam, slid up. She was wearing gauzy scarlet, as befitted her station. You got one picked?
It won't be Booth. He's rank. I can tell. He'll throw his jockey and lose. A horse needs to be ridden hard.
I guess you know a thing or two about that. She patted me on the thigh. I've been thinking about marrying her ever since she came to town, but I keep getting diverted. It was getting along toward one. Time to run the match race on the hanging day, and the rest of Doubtful drifted out. I wondered who was manning the stores. Some unlucky clerk, I suppose. Even Maxwell was out, maybe hoping a horse would drop dead or break a leg, and he could offer a horse funeral for its bereaved master. Well, that crowd knew where to go. Pretty near everyone in town kept going past the starting line and began collecting around the finish, where the finish line judges were eyeing the chalk and studying the course. The judges for this race were King Bragg, off his ranch, and Cromp, the faro dealer at Mrs. Gladstone's sampling room. Doc Harrison was appointed tiebreaker in case the two judges couldn't agree. And now the three were making learned examinations of the track, the noon light, the wind, the sun, and the condition of the heavens. The calmest man around was Limp, who seemed a little bored by it all. Who you betting on? There were always some owners who bet against their own nag.
I don't bet. If I win, my profit's the purse.
He pulled out his turnip watch.
Race time.
And they were off. It wasn't even close. Bark's nag, Sherman, sailed in half a length ahead of Booth, with the kid riding it, flapping around like he couldn't hang on. Booth, ridden by that Swede in purple silks, seemed half awake, even though the Swede was popping his butt with the crop. The judges hardly needed to debate it. The match race man, Limp, was out the stake. Now we'd see if he'd pay up. The jockeys slowed their mounts, turned them, and trotted them back to the finish line. Bark's horse looked like it had barely worked up a sweat, while the matchmaker's nag was lathered through the flanks.
Well, you've some fine, fine horse flesh here, Bark, and my fine little gelding's been properly walked.
He pulled out his little black bag, slowly extracted a mess of 20s, and paid them out, one at a time, to Bark, who watched the bills collect in his horny hand. The bookie, Boston Bill, was paying off some wagers, too, less cheerfully, but even so, it got done. Lots of fellers from Puma County walked off with a few more greenbacks in their britches than they started with, and the day was uncommonly cheerful for them. Bart collected his friends and headed for the Last Chance Saloon to have a lick at the bar before going to the next hanging. The matchmaker and the judges were laying out a half-mile racetrack, this time a big oval with the four corners marked, so people wouldn't have to walk far out of town to see the finish. I didn't know who was running against Limp and his Robert E. Lee, which was one sleek bay that looked like it could whip anything in three states. It got along toward the hanging time, and all the town collected at the gallows. Rusty had chased off the brats who were playing hangman, and he was operating the trapdoors so they dropped proper. It had gotten pretty hot, and the businessmen had doffed their suit coats, and the cowboys had big black stains under their armpits. Earwig pulled out his giant timepiece, decided the moment had come, and climbed up onto the gallows with a megaphone.
Hurry, hurry, hurry! Step right up, see justice done. Time to hang the next batch. When I call your name, step forward and take your medicine, or forever be branded as a craven coward. It's 5 minutes ahead of the hour, but I've elected to get on with it. What's 5 minutes to the condemned? A blink of the eye. All right. Here are the deceased.
Randy Packer. Mulligan Myers. Dinty Stepovich. Walker Wayne. Joe Popper. Big Nose George.
There were little gasps of pleasure as the crowd took the measure of the condemned. Most of them were Flying D men, but a couple were Admiral Ranch men, including Big Nose. Big Nose George moved slowly through the crowd, headed for the gallows, while the crowd watched, electrified. He seemed somehow alone, separated from the hundreds of people surrounding him. It suddenly occurred to me that Big Nose was going to be hanged, and I was going to do the hanging. Big Nose, formidable and heavy, walked slowly to the front of the gallows.
All right. Hang me. Hang me for a little brawling in a saloon. That's a hanging offense.
Hanged by the neck until dead.
The crowd of merrymakers suddenly turned silent. The game was over. Big Nose was calling Earwig's bluff. Earwig could not call Big Nose a coward or a craven criminal. Not now, not ever again.
Go ahead. Hang me, you little fart.
The crowd stirred. This was new and unexpected. This might ruin hanging day. This might turn hanging Judge Earwig into a monster. It had all been fun. Fun to call all the condemned cowards for not showing up for their appointment with the noose. But now the fun stopped cold. I saw a few of those mothers suddenly send their daughters home. Judge Earwig began to redden. He bloated up like a bullfrog, staring at Big Nose, licking his lips, pinking up until I thought he'd burst a blood vessel.
Hang him. Hang him right now.
Big Nose, he calmly stepped onto the trap, fitted the noose over his neck, and even drew it up and twisted the knot so it would snap his neck. He held out his hands to me to tie behind his back. I stared at him. He was calling the game, and he held the aces and twos. The mob down there, they turned so silent that the breeze seemed noisy. I watched George Waller, the mayor, looking rapt and discomfited, and Reggie Thimble swallowing hard, and Delphinium Sanders, the banker's wife who approved of hanging everyone on principle, looking mighty solemn. And I was looking into my own heart, knowing the act of killing the man would be mine alone, and that there was no justice in it, and that Big Nose didn't even deserve an hour in my jail, much less a grave in the little cemetery just outside the city limits.
Do it.
Tell me the law. Let him show me book and verse that said the territory of Wyoming had the lawful right to hang a man for getting into a saloon fight.
What? You'll be next if you don't get busy.
That mob down there, it sure was quiet. Time had stopped. That's the only way I could put it. The clocks all quit.
Hang him!
Hang him!
But Denver Sally had a different view.
Oh, Cotton, don't be a jerk.
Big Nose, he was staring at me, his eyes mocking. He was the winner, in a way. No one would ever call him a coward. I scratched my ear, which is what I do when my brain quits on me. Riley was watching me. So were the Siamese twins. Rusty was quietly waiting. The judge's glare was so fierce it bored right through me. He stood there, a rock of wrath, waiting to hang me too if I didn't comply. I knew pretty much what I had to do, and wondered what it might mean for me. I had to do what was right, and damn the consequences. I unpinned the brass badge I wore on my shirt. It came loose easily, slid out of the gray fabric of my shirt and into my hand. I dropped the badge onto the gallows. The judge seemed to bloat up, and then... I couldn't believe it. There he was, laughing like some old geezer who just told a knee slapper. I am not bright, everyone likes to tell me. And I was even less bright trying to figure this one out. There he was, wheezing away, and pretty soon the crowd, they were hooting and cackling, and there was Big Nose, still solemn, but he had won, and
And no bullying judge would ever call a cowboy a coward or a craven criminal again. Me? I didn't mind the laughter. Let them call me a coward or slow or whatever they want. I'd done what I thought was the right thing. Big Nose came up to me and threw an arm around my shoulder and smiled.
Here's a man. A real man.
I confess I didn't know the difference between a man and any other male, but if he wanted to jabber at me, that was fine. Earwig picked up the badge, slapped it into my hand, and wandered away still laughing. I didn't know whether to pin the badge back on and decided that if I'd resigned, maybe the supervisors needed to appoint me. But then the blamedest thing happened. Reggie Thimble himself, he made his way through the throng, took that brass star out of my hand, and poked the needle part of it through my gray shirt, stabbing me only twice before he got it hooked in proper. So I was sheriff again, but I couldn't figure why. Rusty, cut them nooses off. Hanging day sure was big business in Doubtful, and I thought maybe we should schedule some regular hangings so the shopkeepers could profit. A hanging cost the county some, but the sales made up for it. The crowd had shifted back and forth from Courthouse Square to the racetrack, and now the good people of Doubtful were standing around the track, which consisted of four red flags on poles forming a rectangle. A breeze flapped through the flags and lifted the oppressive heat away. That was the track. The match race would be run outside of the poles. I supposed it was half a mile. Someone with a better brain than mine had figured it out. The start and finish line were one and the same, a white chalk strip on the clay. There was Limp, duded up in a silk stovepipe and tails, his handsome nag, Robert E. Lee, groomed until he shone, with the mane done up in small braids. The Swede jockey stood impassively in his royal purple silks, chewing Bull Durham and watching the crowd. The bookie had a big chalkboard and was offering bets on both nags, with Robert E. Lee the slight favorite. Bet a dollar, make a dollar and a half if the horse won. Pretty slim pickings, but the bookie was collecting cash and handing out chits. I had the feeling that the bookmaker didn't care which nag won. He had his butt covered. There was a smaller crowd around Ulysses Grant, the other horse, a dappled gray that had a little Arab in him if I was any judge. He had the dished Arab head anyway. He was lighter and leaner than Robert E. Lee, and his owner, Milo Drogovich, was holding him quietly. The man had a small ranch on the far edge of the county, almost in high country, on a mountain creek, and no one knew much about him. I sure didn't. I had no idea he raised running horses. This nag, a gelding, stood quietly while the jockey, Drogovich's son, Piers, stood nervously. The boy wasn't wearing silks, but did have a loose white shirt of coarse cotton and carried a small black riding crop. I didn't know you raised runners.
I didn't either. It's just an accident. The boy was running him one day, and I was watching, and I thought, this is a runner. So we worked it. He's the only runner I've ever owned.
A lot of people were listening, and some were even taking notes. What Drogovich was saying, that this was his first attempt to run a horse, immediately cooled a lot of people. I could almost sense the switch to Limp's nag, even though Grant was the local challenger. It got to be race time, hot and dry. And the same judges, Doc Harrison, King Bragg, and Kronk, got lined up, one either side of the line, and one on a stool, looking down in. The jockeys walked and trotted their nags once around the loop, and then lined up at the chalk line. It got real intense there, with half the people in Puma County crowded close. The starter, Bo Windy, got his revolver ready and waited for them jockeys to get lined up, and this time he didn't delay. And away they went. It was a good start. No one broke too soon, and that pair of nags, Bay and Dappled Gray, hunkered low, clattered down the track, turned at the first pole, the gray wider and faster, the bay slower for a moment and cutting sharp, and then they were running the next piece, curving around for the third, with the gray edging half a length ahead and gaining ground. The crowd was real quiet, and even the clatter of hooves was muffled. Sweat was foaming around the flanks of the bay and along the stifle, but I didn't see any stress in the Drogovich horse. They thundered around the final turn, the jockeys low and using their crops, and the Dappled Gray pulled ahead and crossed the chalk a length out front. The crowd hooted, this time at Limp, whose first two horses had lost to locals, and it sure pleased the winners to collect from the bookmaker. Limp headed over to Drogovich, shook his hand, and the rancher was $100 ahead, collecting the match money. The horses trotted in, with the crowds collected around the Gray, admiring it, and
appreciating its sleek body, barely sweated up compared to the wet evening bay. It sure was a fine moment for Doubtful. A professional match horseman had gotten whipped twice. It was the perfect end of the hanging day, and the whole town was celebrating.
Now wait, gents. Is anyone going to match my Myla, Jefferson Davis?
A lot of folks stared at one another. Ranch horses weren't known for long distance running and were largely bred to maneuver cattle. Still, there was Limp, with some losers in his string, and another day of racing if anyone wanted to challenge him. That's when the stranger stepped up. Young feller, with down at the heels boots. Raggedy shirt, skinny, a big Adam's apple, and a stubble of blonde beard on him.
I guess I got here just in time. You looking for a match?
I suddenly was aware that he was leading a sorrel horse, with no markings on him, plain as horses get, but long and built on thoroughbred lines.
Well, I'm looking, but I'm not sure you'd want to match that horse against mine. I've got to tell you, my horse has walked away with more match meets than I can count.
I got a nice runner here. He's proved out. I've got a pasture with some stumps in it, and I run him around a big circle in there. My friends all say this boy's a runner for sure, and he likes a long run, too.
Has he ever been in competition?
Well, I matched him up with other horses on the ranch and around there, and he done real good.
Where are you from, fella?
Medicine Bow County, next to here. I'm Elmer Scruggs.
Well, Elmer, I don't think you'd want to risk $100 of match money. That's a lot for a cowboy.
Well, me and my friends, we got $100 together.
You'll just lose it, boy. This horse, Jefferson Davis, is the fastest streak of lightning in the West. And he's good for a lot more than a mile, too. You better think on it, boy.
Well, I come a long way to race this pup here. Across one county and half across another. All on foot, too.
By now, the two were collecting a crowd. There were plenty of local cowboys eyeing the new horse they'd never seen and shaking their heads. These cowboys knew horse flesh and knew a runner when they saw one. And this nag wasn't making a dent in their thinking.
I come a long way. I come to race.
I don't like easy pickings, boy. You season him and bring him around next year. And I'll meet you here and we'll have a regular run for the money.
You mind if I just give him a little run around this here track you got set up? I'd sure like to show you how this sorrel runs.
What's his name?
His name is Jones. You get a plain horse, you want to give him a regular name. You wouldn't want to call this sorrel horse Lord Fauntleroy.
Sure, we'll all watch Jones. That'll cap the day all right.
Oh, this is what we wanted. I'll just put a regular saddle on him, not a racing pad. We'll do a loop.
He led the horse to the makeshift track while a lot of people studied him, walked the horse, then trotted him, and finally settled the sorrel into a rocking chair lope, the easiest gait for most horses. And that old sorrel kind of settled into a run, and somehow even at that relaxed lope gave the impression nothing could pass him by. That was all. Elmer Scruggs reined Jones to a halt and sat there waiting. Limp looked him over and made a decision.
Boy, you want a match race, you got one. Put up 100 and we'll run tomorrow.
I'd never seen anything like it. The whole town was getting heated up about it. The town swiftly divided into two camps. Some were supporting the stranger, Elmer Scruggs, and his horse Jones. That sorrel, they said, had all the mysterious powers of a great horse, and the lope around the track proved it. They were going to lay money on Jones and walk away with plenty, because Jones was the underdog and he'd go off at high odds. But the rest of the town, including all the fellers who thought they knew horse flesh, they were ready to lay cash on Jefferson Davis. The oracle for that crowd was Turk himself, the liveryman with a lot of experience in gauging horses. Turk was opining that Limp's Classy Bay would run several lengths ahead when the finish line loomed up, and that only suckers and innocents saw anything to like in Jones. Doubtful wanted Jones to whip that Confederate horse being put up by that slick operator named Limp, who probably was a man with a checkered past, though no one could prove it, and I couldn't find any wanted dodgers on him. He seemed square enough, if you didn't look real close. It was sort of turning into the experts against the sentimental, the fellers who knew nags against the wishful thinkers. It was as if the reputation of Puma County was really at stake. No outside nag was going to walk away with the stakes if they could help it. Well, all this struck me as odd, since no one could point to a record by either horse, and no one could say they'd seen either horse in a race. it sure got me to scratching my head some. The bookie, Boston Bill, acted like he didn't much care who won. It was all mathematical science for him. But he'd get his 30% cut no matter which horse won. He took bets and wrote out chits, and I got to wondering how much cash that feller was taking in and where it went. The way things were going, he'd stand to make a lot of money, the way the whole town was laying bets on him. I wasn't quite sure how his game worked, but I knew he would calculate the odds in a way that gave him 30% of the take no matter what, and it looked now like Boston Bill would get 30% of $10,000 or $20,000 of wagering. Hubert Sanders had announced he'd open the bank at 8 instead of 10, since so many people wanted to get some cash. It was looking like this match race would have about half the loose cash and doubtful riding on it, and no one could tell me why, since no one could say for sure what horse was a good runner. Boston Bill had come into town with Limp, but always hovered a little out of the way, just acting like he barely knew Limp and was along to make a few greenbacks if he could. I wondered some about Boston Bill, but I could find nothing about him in the Wanted Dodgers. He was dapper, wearing a black bowler and a collarless shirt, and a spray of Lilies of the Valley tucked into his lapel. Maybe that was his mark, Lilies in the lapel. He was easy to find, even if he seemed to keep a little distance from the crowd. Well, I went to bed at Bell's boarding house. I'd gotten my room back now that the Ukrainians were bedded down at Rusty's cabin, and slept fitfully, knowing I'd have a tough time of it the next day if a riot started. This here match race might end up killing a few people if I didn't keep the peace. By dawn, I was up and prowling. When a town like Doubtful gets heated up, full of cowboys and brimming with people in from every neighboring town, I get itchy. I ate at Barney's Beanery and headed for the sheriff's office to feed the drunks. And found Rusty asleep in a cell. He smiled and bobbed up when I growled at him.
Oh, I'm worn out. Two wives is one too many. I'm gonna hide in here for a while. I'm half ruined.
You could divorce one. By the time I reached the streets for my morning rounds, a crowd had gathered at the Merchant Bank. Hubert Sanders opened the door and the mob flooded in, forming a line at one open wicket.
They're all taking out cash to bet on the race.
You got enough?
I hope so. Maybe I'll have to borrow from Boston Bill. It's all going into his pocket.
And the morning's hardly begun. It's a long time until the race.
I don't like it, Sheriff. This deal bothers me.
I've been wondering about a crooked race. Them jockeys could throw it and make some money that way.
I just don't like it.
I watched the line move through the bank, with all sorts of strangers withdrawing cash or changing 20s and 50s into 5s and 1s. I had never seen the like. I headed over to Turk, who was holding court in his livery barn. You got any way of seeing whether this race gets throwed?
If that's your worry, forget it. I'll be watching. I know every game from hamstringing to putting a burr under the saddle. You're worrying about that? I'll be there, and I'll guarantee you a clean race. If I see some hanky-panky, you'll be the first to know it.
That's mighty fine, mighty fine.
It's that cowboy Scruggs worries me. He's a little too smiley. I'll be studying on him. Nothing gets by me. There ain't a trick I haven't seen.
I found Algernon Limp eating grits and cornbread in the little dining room of that hotel. He sure looked dapper, dressed up for race day with a red paisley cravat, fresh iron shirt with a new collar, newly brushed black suit, and patent leather shoes, wiped clean for the great day. Well, Algernon, who's going to win?
Well, funny you should ask that, Sheriff. When I first saw that rube and his red nag, I thought it's a joke. But now I'm thinking it'll be a tight race.
Well, what changed your mind, sir?
That boy, he's a horse whisperer. He senses what's going on in a horse's brain, and he tells that horse to run, and the horse takes orders.
You got the judges lined out?
Same as before, and I'm putting observers at the far flag so no one cuts a corner.
Sounds dandy, Mr. Limp. What'll you do after this one?
Pack up, go to the next town, my jockey and me.
You travel with Boston Bill?
Oh, no. He just shows up wherever he thinks he can run a game.
He's taking heavy bets this morning.
I'm sure he is. I've never seen a match race that generated so much interest as this one. It's one for the record books, wouldn't you say?
Beats me. Well, given the amount of cash changing hands, I'd better head out to the racetrack and keep an eye on Boston Bill. That man might need protecting. I'd never seen such a mob. Most of Puma County was there, and plenty from the surrounding counties, too. I guess word got out, and there were people come 100 miles just for this race. They were setting up to stay a while at the track, putting down blankets to sit on and carrying picnic baskets. The ladies had got up in their best finery, lots of big straw hats against the August sun. I sure enjoy seeing women who are dolled up and looking flirty. The heat was building, and I knew we'd all get burnt and roasted this race day, and I hoped people had sense enough to stay under big hats. By noon, the crowd had swelled to a couple thousand, which was more than we had in the county, so they were sure pouring in. Boston Bill had a chalkboard on a tripod where he posted the latest odds. The Sorrel was the long shot, and if he won, he would pay out 5-for-1. A feller could make a sawbuck on a $2 bet. Most of the smart money was on the Confederate horse, as he was being called, and the winners wouldn't collect much, but they were calling it a sure thing, so it didn't matter. There were a lot of Union men who wouldn't put a plugged nickel on a Reb horse, and a lot more who itched for a local horse like Jones to cop the race. Much to my surprise, Walt Zablonski, sheriff of Medicine Bow County, showed up. He didn't say much, just eyed me, eyed the track, eyed the bookmaker, Boston Bill, and eyed the competitors, Algernon Limp and Elmer Scruggs. It sure made me curious. Maybe there was more to it, but Zablonski wasn't talking. Boston Bill sure was doing a business. Folks were lined up to lay some greenbacks on him, and he received each bettor courteously, making sure people got the exact change and a printed yellow ticket with the words Davis or Jones carefully written into the blank on the ticket.
Winners, redeem your tickets 10 minutes after the race and after the judges have declared the final results. I'll post the results on the chalkboard.
The judges were all on hand early, all dressed in black suits for the occasion, in spite of the hot sun. King Bragg at least doffed his suit coat until race time. But Kronk, the faro dealer, seemed impervious to the heat and just sat in a folding chair, smoking cigarillos and watching the mob. Doc Harrison was busy treating heat stroke, so he didn't have a chance to stand around and look important. By 1:30, the place was half crazy. People were still in line buying chips from Boston Bill, but now Bill was saying that he'd quit selling 10 minutes ahead of the race. Sure enough, 10 minutes to 2, he shut down.
Sorry, fella, it's race time now. Betting is closed. Hear that? Closed now!
The crowd got the word and drifted away.
Sheriff, can you point twice the nearest necessary?
If you mean outhouse, behind the last chance.
Watch over my deal here.
I kept an eye on his seat and chalkboard and a small black bag, glad to be of assistance. Well, race time rolled around. The owners shook hands, the jocks mounted. The nags would go twice around the track, and the chalk line was both the starting and finish line. So that's where the big crowd collected, as many in the infield as outside the loop. At the stroke of 2, King Bragg addressed the riders.
Jockeys, line up your mounts!
The jockeys lined up the horses at the line, with the Swede having a little trouble holding in the bay. Limp, dressed to the nines, watched blandly. He'd been through all this lots of times. I sure got fascinated. Scruggs sat easily on his red horse, but Engstrom looked twitchy. A fair start, and the race was on. They ran neck and neck through the first loop, with the Confederate nag on the outside and taking broader sweeps around the corners. But as they raced into the second loop, Jefferson Davis pulled ahead, running easily, and pretty soon it was a length, then 2, then 3, and finally 4 lengths ahead at the finish. It was a clear victory and beyond dispute. The crowd watched silently. There hadn't been enough drama to stir up much feeling. The horses slowed, their flanks heaving, their stifles sweat-soaked in the heat, and the jocks turned them back to the finish line where the crowd waited. The horses stood at last before the crowd, their jockeys relaxed. King Bragg consulted briefly with the other judges.
The winner of this match race is Jefferson Davis by 4 lengths. The judges are unanimous. This race is over. The stakes go to Algernon Limp, owner of the bay.
The crowd examined its race tickets, and the ones who put cash on Jones were pitching their tickets away, while the larger crowd that put money on Davis began lining up at the bookmaker's stand, where the chalkboard still stood on its tripod with the final odds written on it. But Boston Bill was nowhere in sight. He'll be right back. But he didn't return. Off a bit, Engstrom was walking his bay, while Limp watched. Scruggs' face was a mask. He and his cowboy buddies in the next county had hoped for a big upset, and that hadn't happened. Sheriff Zablonski of Medicine Bow edged up to me.
It's like I figured. You better find Boston Bill and fast, and maybe put those other two behind bars.
What?
Well, it's just like I thought. The three are in cahoots, along with the jockey. Oh, they pulled this in Rock Springs and cleaned up.
What are you saying?
Find Boston Bill fast. He probably skipped town. And that kid there, Scruggs, he's not from Medicine Bow County. No one's ever heard of him. It's a simple deal. These three travel together. They find a county seat like this. Boston Bill sets up shop. These two run the races, sometimes throwing the race one way or another if it suits.
There were plenty of people listening, and the result was a human thunderstorm. Sheriff, keep order here. I'm going after him.
Not my county.
You're deputized right now. I stared at the crowd, a giant thunderclap in the making, and then raced toward town. I hardly knew where to look. Boston Bill could have dodged anyway, down any road. Maybe he was still there, waiting for the moment to go. I raced along Wyoming Street. Turk's place was my first stop. That's where a man could get a saddle horse. But Turk's was deserted, like the rest of the town. If Boston Bill had stolen a horse and saddle, no one was around to stop it. I stared down side streets, studied distant roads. Then I remembered the Laramie and Overland stage. A mud wagon was due to leave about race time. That office was two blocks up Wyoming on the west side of town, as far from the racetrack as one could get. It was deserted except for a clerk and a sleeve garter. Laramie stage leave?
Yep, you're too late.
Who was on it?
Oh, I don't know. A couple of whiskey drummers. Oh, one patent medicine salesman.
Wearing what?
Was something bothering you, Sheriff?
Any carrying big bags?
Well, they all carry a samples bag. That's for taking orders. And a valise.
The patent medicine man, what was he carrying?
Beats me. Maybe small case, like a sample case.
Was he in a hurry? Breathing hard?
No, he bought a ticket to Laramie, paid cash, sat down, waited for the Jehu to load up, and that was that.
How far out are they now?
Left 50 minutes ago. Must be 4 miles out.
There was a wire that went to the courthouse. I headed that way, hoping I'd find Wiley Wills, the telegraph operator. I'd telegraph Laramie, get them to hold all passengers on that stage. I huffed my way to the courthouse, but there was no one in the place. No telegrapher. There were only two people in Doubtful who could tap out a message, and they were not around. Dang! I could saddle Critter up and try to catch up and hope one of the three passengers was Boston Bill, or I could keep on looking in town. I chose to stay. There was trouble brewing right here. The whole town was like a warehouse of giant powder ready to blow. I didn't know what would happen, but it was going to be as bad as anything I'd ever faced. By the time I got to the racetrack, things were out of hand. A mob surrounded Zablonski, demanding that he produce Boston Bill. There were other mobs surrounding Limp and Scruggs, and about all I heard was shouting. Another crowd had corralled the judges and were threatening to pulverize them. I looked for Rusty, but he wasn't around. And it was going to be me against not one, but several mobs, all ready for a fight. King Bragg still had a megaphone in hand, so I figured I'd get to him. If I could get the mob quieted down, maybe I could keep the place safe. But when I tried to push through the angry crowd, they simply grabbed me.
Sheriff, where's my money? What are you going to do?
I'm gonna keep the peace and you're gonna let go of me. But they didn't let go. In fact, they started blaming me.
Why didn't you nab them?
Some sheriff. These crooks need hanging, and where were you?
It wasn't hard to see where all this was heading. A lynching was building up, and this mob might well lynch a dozen people before it quit. They had swarmed Scruggs and Limp and were holding both. King Bragg saw what was building, climbed up on the nearest wagon and began yelling.
I'm a judge here. I'm telling you to quiet down. Now listen to me.
Hang these bastards. String them up.
The crowd turned on King Bragg and knocked him down and started kicking him. I waded in, working toward Bragg, and found myself being yanked and hauled by more hands than I could count. Someone got my revolver.
Woo-hoo, I got you.
Give me that. Go home. It's over. But the mob wasn't listening. I saw a mess of cowboys catch the match race contestants, Scruggs and Limp, and wrestle them down. The two horses went berserk, kicking anyone inside. But a dozen cowboys grabbed their bridles and hauled the horses out.
Kill them!
The word spread through the jostling crowd like a tightening noose. I could see them catching the judges, Doc Harrison, Kronk, and Bragg himself. The cowboys were whipping off their bandanas and using them to tie up the contestants and judges, and then they started on me. I bucked and dodged. I saw Sheriff Zablonski up on a wagon yelling, but they were ignoring him too.
You all hang!
That simply heated up the game, and the mob began jeering. The mob took on a life of its own, and people knew instinctively what to do and who to fight. I knew where this would end, and I looked desperately for help from Rusty. But there wasn't a soul except the lynch mob. The women had fled, and the business people soon after. And all that remained out there, next to the horse track, was a crazed mob bent on revenge, lawfully or not. I saw no sign of Judge Earwig either. He'd gotten out while he could. The fact of the matter was that within minutes, the mob had me hogtied, Sheriff Zablonski tied up, the judges bound head to toe, and the two contestants tied up, stomped on, breathing raggedly, and fearing what would come next. I saw Alvin Ream and Admiral Ranch Cowboy in the midst of it.
Alvin, stop this! Before something happens, you'll regret!
Whoa!
He responded with a kick to my ribs. The mob got a wagon, lifted me and the judges and the neighboring sheriff into it, and pulled the wagon into town. That was the last I saw of Limp and Scruggs. The law, what was left of it, was tied up tight. One cowboy had no trouble digging my jail key out of my pocket, and I had an idea what would happen. Sure enough, they dragged the wagon to the jail, yanked us out, none of us could stand or walk, and dragged us into the jail and into cell number 2.
Where's the rope?
They found it easily enough and headed out the door. It suddenly was real quiet in there, and real quiet in town. There hadn't been a soul on the streets when they hauled us down Wyoming to Courthouse Square, and now Doubtful was dead silent. I eyed the others, who were all wrestling with the bandanas that bound them. Zablonski was the first to muscle his hands loose, and in short order he had freed the rest of us. I hurt. The rest hurt. Some of us were bleeding, but the bandanas soon became bandages stopping the blood. My nose had taken a fist and was swollen red and thick. The moment came when we'd done all the doctoring we could manage in the dim light. We knew what was surely happening not far away in the square where the gallows still stood. But in the cell there was only silence, and we were alone with our thoughts. I was wondering what I might have done better, and Zablonski must have seen it in me.
Wasn't a Ned Buntline moment, was it?
What are you talking about?
Ned Buntline writes dime novels with outlandish heroes doing impossible things.
Like stopping a lynching?
Okay, here's how the dime novel story would go. The brave sheriff, armed with a shotgun, would stand in the path of the lynchers, daring them to walk past him. They would see the shotgun, and they would see the sheriff ready to use it, and they would falter, and the lynchers would quit, and the sheriff would be celebrated as a hero.
I'm no dime novel, Sheriff. We all knew what was happening, and I felt bad.
Yeah, well, that's the dime novel world with dime novel heroes, not the real world. You don't have to beat on yourself.
But none of the others were joining in, and I sensed they thought I'd let them down, let law and order down, let those two horse racers down.
A mob is an animal, and sometimes you can't stop it, and bravery isn't going to help a lawman. That's the real world, not the fictional one.
You did what you could, Cotton.
But we all knew that just outside away, there were two bodies swinging in the breeze. Live men one moment, gone the next. I had let them down, let justice down. And nothing would change my mind about that. I can't remember a darker moment in my life. It wasn't only that I had failed. It was that the people in the town I lived in had turned savage and had murdered two strangers as swiftly and easily as if they were shooting a deer. Something had taken hold of them, tossed all reason and restraint to the wind, fired them up, and turned them into a howling pack of killers. There were men I knew among them, men capable of murder. The same thoughts must have been threading through the minds of the rest of us in there. They stared bleakly through the bars, waiting to be released, wondering when or whether we'd be released. Someone would turn us loose. Maybe. The clock ticked onward, and the silence outside only deepened through the afternoon, and I had a sense that people had fled Doubtful, ran as far as they could, as fast as they could from the horror. We saw Judge Earwig lumbering toward us.
Will you let me go? They still have your deputy somewhere. They're not letting him go until you promise you won't bring charges. He has the key to here, I don't.
I'm sworn to uphold the law.
You need food and water. I can't unlock without a key.
The others were staring at me, maybe hating me. They wanted to get out, no matter what the price. Find One-Eyed Jack. He can cut us out with his blacksmith tools. And see if you can find Bertel, my part-time deputy.
Bertel's dead. He tried to stop them, so they strung him up.
Bertel?
Who knows who else? I'll be back with something.
Water now, please.
The judge nodded and returned with a bucket of clear water that he set just outside the bars and a dipper. He passed the filled dipper through the bars. Harrison immediately offered each prisoner a good sip.
Who's dead?
Limp, Scruggs, Bertel, and a stranger.
The bookmaker, Boston Bill?
No, he's gone.
Well, who negotiated with you, sent you here?
I don't know. They wore bandanas over their faces. I'll be back shortly.
He returned in a while with a pot of beans from Barney's Beanery and with the blacksmith.
It'll take a few hours to cut you loose, or I can bust the lock.
Bust it.
What do I tell the mob? I'll hang the lot?
Stay here. Don't tell them anything.
Jack had done the job. He drew the bolt and the door swung open. We stepped into bleakness. Free at last, but my tasks had only begun. Arm yourselves if you want, Your Honor. I found a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun. The rest chose to let things lie. We went to the door and stepped out upon a bleak scene. Four bodies hung from the gallows, swaying slightly in the August breezes. There wasn't a soul in the square. There wasn't a sound issuing from any window or building. There wasn't a horse or wagon or cart or ox team on the square. Where were you to meet the ringleaders?
At the gallows.
I'll go talk.
I wanted Rusty real bad. He was in big trouble. I wasn't even sure he was alive. And I had no idea where to find him. I walked out onto the lonely square, walking steadily, my shotgun cradled in my arm. The gallows loomed above me with their dismal burden. Each man dangling, hands tied, neck snapped, head sideways, tongues bulging out a limp and Bertel. Each body swayed slightly. Nothing under their boots but air. Once there had been the trap, solid and treacherous, but the trap hung straight down on its hinges. I stood at the gallows, waiting, wondering whose eyes were watching me from what dark window fronted the square. There must have been 100 windows, each hiding its own dark secrets. No one showed up. I sat on the edge of the gallows for a while, seeing not one soul. My guess was that they had fled, every last one, as the reality of their crime overwhelmed them. And if so, I'd have to find and free Rusty on my own. The likeliest place was the courthouse, so I walked there, a solitary man doing a solitary task. The place was empty. I routinely checked each office as I made my way toward Judge Earwig's chamber, and when I got to the courtroom, there was Rusty, gagged and tied, but alive. I pulled the gag off his face and then wrestled with the bandanas that had wrapped his numb arms and legs. Rusty didn't say anything. He just stared at me, and I stared at him, and some understanding passed between us. He could name names, for sure, but I didn't ask him, and he didn't volunteer any. His holster was empty. The judge kept a pitcher of water and some glasses there, and I poured a glass for Rusty. Bertel's dead.
He was trying to stop the mob. He deserves a medal.
Are we negotiating with anyone now?
They ran.
Who's the stranger they hanged?
No one knows. They just picked on him.
Cut Bertel loose first, and lay him out proper. And then the rest. No one was talking. I intended to level murder charges against those who'd lynched four mortals that August afternoon. I knew plenty of the people who were rioting at the racetrack, but that didn't help. They all professed not to know who strung up the match race contestants and my part-time deputy. Puma County had a guilty secret, and it looked like it would stay that way, and that's the way they wanted it. I spent days poking and probing and got nowhere. But I knew that someday, Sooner or later, some witness would start spilling the facts. And then I'd make sure the guilty were brought to justice. Odd how the town changed. People were afraid to talk to me. I walked around there in isolation. Maybe the ones who did the lynching were threatening those who watched them do it. Maybe the reason no witness came to me was because he feared for his life if he did. I could only wait, because someday the whole story would spill and I'd do what the law required me to do. There was new pressure to get rid of me, too. The fastest way to bury the lynching was to oust me from the sheriff's office. And sure enough, that's what happened. The county supervisors called me in one afternoon and told me they were firing me. They said I'd caused damage to county property, namely the cell door, and that was reason enough to discharge me. I stared at Reggie Thimble and Ziggy Camp and smiled. They smiled back. They knew what they were doing and why, and it didn't have anything to do with the wrecked cell door. Rusty and I buried Bertel, since no one else was around to do it. The old deputy was a loner, with no family we could find, so we got Maxwell to dig a grave for us in the town cemetery, and we laid our friend to rest there. His last efforts were to restore peace in town, and he deserved better than he got. He took with him the secret of who strung him up, but me and Rusty, we knew we'd find out eventually. Bad secrets always boil to the surface. The supervisors didn't appoint Rusty sheriff. They knew he'd do what I would do and keep after the case until he had the lynchers behind bars. Or maybe they didn't like the idea of a sheriff married to Siamese twins. By then, both Natasha and Anna were expecting, and Rusty's family would soon grow. They let Rusty stay on as deputy, mostly because the Siamese twins were becoming a tourist attraction and bringing coin to Doubtful. And until the supervisors got around to finding someone new, Rusty would be the acting sheriff. I collected Critter and moved out. I got word from the Wyoming Cattlemen's Association that they wanted to talk to me. So I did, and the upshot of all that was a new job at $80 a month as a range detective with the association, keeping rustling at bay. The cattlemen had been losing a lot of beef, and they wanted to put a stop to it and figured I was the man, and I could stay right in Doubtful. So I left my shiny badge with Supervisor Thimble. It was untarnished. I'd never dishonored my badge. But the county and town that employed me now had a guilty secret, and I thought it was a good thing to let go of it, at least for a while. And I had a hunch that my new job as a range detective would lead me to the things no one was talking about, such as who did the lynching in Pima County that August day. The story wasn't over yet, and neither was my life. Like my ma used to say, you ain't old until you're 40. Blood Valley 6, Support Your Local Deputy, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2013, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication prohibited. Performed by Ken Jackson, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Elizabeth Demery, Terrence Aselford, Evan Casey, Ren Casey, Michael John Casey, Jeff Allen, Eric Messner, Patrick Busick, Tim Pabone, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Timothy Lynch, Daniel Sontag, Matthew Bassett, Nora Ashrati, James Konacek, David Jordan, Mort Shelby, Christopher Graybill, James Keegan, and Gregory Gorton. Directed by Ken Jackson. Book adapted for graphic audio by Scott McCormick. Dialogue editing by Damian Choppy Chop Richardson. Graphic audio sound design by Justin Wirtz. Original music by Thomas Hogan and Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Blood Valley, be sure to look for the series Sidewinders, as well as The Last Gunfighter, available at Road Stops Everywhere. at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.